This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of June 29th, 2025. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 402. Happy Canada Day and happy 4th of July to listeners in the U.S. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest. I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker. And on the Big Deal feature, top legal experts from Canada, US, UK, and Ireland came together at the Vancouver Anti-Corruption Institute. The two-day conference featured a keynote speech by Kevin Brasseau, Canada's fentanyl czar. The Breaker.News was there. Plus, Alan Mullen returns to talk about his connection to Melissa Hortman, the former speaker of Minnesota's legislature who was killed by an assassin on June 14th. Alan explains why Canada needs to do more to combat political violence. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. Kevin Brasseau spent more than 20 years in the RCMP, including deployment in British Columbia and later as the top Mountie in Manitoba and Deputy Commissioner. Last year, Brasseau became the National Security and Intelligence Advisor to Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. In February, Brasseau got a new assignment after Donald Trump demanded Justin Trudeau and Canada do more to fight the fentanyl crisis affecting North America. His official title is Commissioner of Canada's Fight Against Fentanyl. But Brasseau is better known as the Fentanyl Czar. On June 17th, Kevin Brasseau was the keynote speaker at the Vancouver Anti-Corruption Institute's 2025 conference on asset forfeiture. Here is what he had to say.
It's so wonderful to be back in Vancouver. I cut my teeth as a young member of the RCMP in and around this town and in other places like Williams Lake and Beaver Creek, Yukon, all the hot spots of places that you know much about. And while I have this in the nomenclature, a title that my spouse and family roll their eyes about frequently, I am formally called the Commissioner of Canada's Fight Against Fentanyl. And look, after spending most of my adult life in public service, but for a brief interlude of private practice in a white shoe firm in New York, it has been about public service and taking and answering the call. And I want to start by saying something, I guess, very plainly, that it brings me to why I'm with you here today. I don't take many speaking engagements, but I thought this was a really interesting opportunity of a group of incredibly talented individuals who are focused, singularly focused on making this country better, that I would give a perspective about what it could be about. It's certainly law and theory, but it's also at its core about public safety and public wellness and human suffering. That is what we are trying to deal with and avoid. And I've put my fair share of people in jail, written some ITOs over the course of my time, executed search warrants and led teams around organized crime. But the hardest hits that you can deal with in many cases to organize and criminal organizations are made not only in cuffs and courtrooms, but they're made when you take their stuff away. Time and time again, it is about that opportunity to be able to take from someone things that they've taken from somebody else. And whether that's the physical assets, their homes, otherwise, but their crypto wallets, etc., the things that make that world go around. And frankly, I personalized so much of this, and I think that I'm very blessed. I've worked very, very hard for the things I have, and there's a bit of a pain in me when I see someone that has a nicer car than me and has a bigger house than me and doesn't work. And I think that we are at a moment in time, I believe, in our country and I've heard it over the course of my career, but certainly over the course of the last number of months. And you heard it in the recent election, both provincially, I think you hear it municipally, and certainly federally. Canadians are fed up and want to make sure that all elements of public institutions and frankly, civil society and corporations are doing their part to right the wrong. And asset forfeiture is such an important element, and not a side strategy from my view. It's not an add-on, it's a frontline weapon in the fight against organized crime. So criminal prosecutions, of course, and asset forfeiture can and should move in parallel. It is a deliberate choice that ought to be made, and you all know all of this, of course, inherently, and it's not that either or. In fact, I think when they move together, they reinforce each other, and forfeiture can allow us to act and allow all of you to act swiftly, surgically, and strategically, especially when criminal charges can be delayed, complicated, or disrupted by procedural hurdles. And I've heard a lot about that. You will pick up a paper at some point. Who picks up a paper? Maybe just me. I'm old enough to do that, I suppose. But you will read about, oh, there's Stinchcomb. Oh, there's Jordan. There's O'Connor. Over and over, the cases of the tapestry that has been weaved in this country with the criminal law. Well, that is the criminal law. We are a rule of law country. We can't throw all that out and pretend it doesn't exist. So we use the tools, of course, that are available to all of you. And that's why it's so cool to be in BC, because of course, the model in British Columbia and other jurisdictions. I was fortunate enough to be in Manitoba from 2012 to 2016 and saw that model work really, really effectively. And in fact, even listing the Hells Angels as an organization, I thought was an important step in the province of Manitoba at the time. Somebody's here from Manitoba, I forget who. A whole bunch of folks. Yeah, you wouldn't think. I'm a big fan, and again, it's using those tools that are available to you, and really focusing on disrupting. I know that we've heard a lot about disruption, and frankly, we throw a lot of terminology. But what does it actually mean? To me, it's in some cases creating an inhospitable environment, which I'm not apologizing about. I think being inhospitable as a Canadian perhaps is against my fabric, but in this case, I'm not too shy about doing that. The BC CFO have done amazing work, and you're going to hear more about that later on. But the amount of referrals and the thousands is incredible. A self-funded organization. Reinvesting those funds directly into efforts that support community safety, policing, and victim services. That's what smart enforcement in this ecosystem looks like. It's responsible, sustainable, and accountable. And it's that sophistication which is really key. Carrying out the proceeds of crime charges or net worth analyses, and we recognize that criminal processes can stall. Especially when witnesses disappear and procedural issues arise, as I mentioned, that's where you really become important. So while BC has taken that leadership role, and I love talking about the great work you do here, of course, the critical works have been done in other places, of course, across country, Alberta, Ontario, Quebec. And as I mentioned, Manitoba, and there needs to be more. We definitely need a nationalized system, or at least a homogenous system around the country of where and we'll hear about it at FATF for sure later on this year about how important that is. Why? Because crooks don't care about borders. Whenever we play these siloed, kind of border-driven jurisdictional rules, criminals smile and families cry. So as we see increasingly complex cases where crime occurs in one province and assets are held in another, that interprovincial cooperation and asset sharing agreements become essential. So no province should face jurisdictional barriers when fighting organized crime. And I think that's why the Canada's national strategy, as I mentioned, must continue to foster that alignment, the interoperability, and fair distribution of recovered assets. And these actions aren't just about clawing back money, they shift the burden. And that burden's important. And I recognize, of course, always, we're in a rule of law country, but it is important to have and force and ask individuals to explain where those assets come from and make sure that message is sent clear that dirty money shouldn't be able to be permitted to hide. That's my philosophical bent. It takes me back to first year con law, I suppose, and I would probably fail if I spoke that way in first year con law, but that's what a few decades of dealing with crime has done to me, to give me perspective from first year con law. So let me talk a little bit about my job and the fentanyl crisis that exists in this country. Many of you, of course, will know it as well as I. I've been honored and blessed to have the incredible ability to be able to convene and listen and really try to sponge the stories from across this country. And February 11th was a bit of an auspicious day for me because it was not what I expected to happen that day. As I was minding my own business, walking the halls of the Prime Minister's office, ready to give advice on the latest national security issue, and in conversations, of course, you know the history, the conversations between then Prime Minister and the President about the issues that were facing the United States and the concern around the implications to Canada, and I was appointed as the first person with a name like a czar. And while of course that is a term of art, it's one I tried to fight for a while, but I just couldn't. I suppose it's like a nickname when you're a kid; it sticks with you, and you go back to your high school reunion, and people call you that. It feels a little bit like that that to me, but it resonates. I will say in many places, when I'm dealing with my colleagues or counterparts, I won't call them colleagues, counterparts in the U.S., whether that's Tom Homan or others, they get the fact, because what comes along with the term and the name is a person who's point, a person who's responsible, a person who will be singularly focused on a particular issue, and that's a bit how I've taken this on. And I tell you that it also will give, has given frontline workers across this country, parents, grandparents, a sense of hope that somebody's going to do something about it. Fentanyl is killing 21 Canadians per day. Synthetic opioids. 21 people per day are dying, a decade really after it became front and center in this country. Almost 50,000 people have died, and there is a bit of ray of hope that the death rates are a bit on the decline after really being on the steep incline, particularly during COVID when borders shut down and it just threw everything out of whack. And if you aggregate, the numbers are going down, but in Quebec they're going up, and in places around the country they're going up. In small remote communities, in particular Indigenous communities around the country, they are not going down, and the devastating impact that has. So it's not just a public health emergency, it's a national security threat. The synthetic drug trade is now the largest criminal market in Canada, and it's not just about what comes in. It's about what gets produced here and gets sent abroad. And I know we had a conversation earlier this morning about Australia, recognizing the fact that they know where some of their production comes from. Fentanyl and other related synthetic opioids have really gotten a foothold on main streets across this country, small or large. And mayors that I've met with are really struggling with what to do. And I'm trying to give them a bit of help in finding the tools to be able to succeed. Fentanyl and the opioids, related opioids, fuel violence, corruption, arms trafficking, human smuggling, and cybercrime. They distort our housing market, launder through shell companies, and quietly erode the rule of law. And as I mentioned, that is what Canadians feel to me. At least maybe I live in a bit of an echo chamber, but they're fed up. And they're concerned about, and really I think are questioning the fabric of the systems that are meant to be in place to be able to protect them, whether that's getting on the subway, stepping out of your condo in downtown, pick a city, and what you're going to see in any given morning, and whether it's going to be safe for your children. I'm also the parent of a teenage boy, and it is a conversation around the dinner table in suburbia, Canada, that I'd never really heard as much about before, and it is quite startling about what they're concerned about, and what I'm concerned about is what pill is going to be taken by accident that will shatter everybody's life. So that's the crisis we're dealing with. That is the situation we're in. And I think we're at a moment in time where governments and organizations like all of you belong to that perhaps is a bit like we found ourselves in March 2020, where we could have done the same old thing, reacted perhaps the same way, but in terms of how governments came together, premiers and prime ministers were talking and working together, Government of Canada instituted funding and put in place supports like never before. It's in the face of the 50 reasons why you can't do something. Do not be one of the 50, be one of the people that come up with the 50 reasons why you can't, find the one reason why you can. And that's really where I feel that we're perhaps at that moment, perhaps an inflection point that we can perhaps do something about it. And that's why I was frankly very proud to be able to have a helping hand, modest and very limited as it was, that the Government of Canada was able to table Bill C-2 in the House a couple weeks ago, the Strong Borders Act. C-2, I have never seen a public safety type of related bill that early in a legislative agenda. I will be corrected. I'm in the room with a prime minister, which makes me nervous, and a former justice minister, because she'll remind me about a number of bills that came in that early, but it speaks to the importance around a legislative package that strengthens detection at ports, expands data sharing amongst and across departments, tightens a financial noose around transnational organized crime, actually is trying to get lawful access back on the agenda. There's likely a lot. I know there are some law enforcement folks in here that conversation has happened many, many more times. Canada Post giving the authority to actually get a search warrant for Post, like just some fundamental cleanup elements that were really, really important that will speak to dealing with the ecosystem that is the fentanyl trade. So it's a border bill, but it also recognizes the fact that you squeeze the side of a balloon on one side, it's going to pop out on another. You focus on what happens at the border, it will impact on what happens on Main Street. If you focus on Main Street, it'll happen. It'll have knock-on impacts about what's happening at the border. So it is a bit, colleagues, of all hands on deck. And again, I'm sorry to say, we all have a role. We all have a role to play. And that legislation builds on a significant financial investment. You know about it in the fall, the border plan that dedicated $1.3 billion. And you can be cynical and say, well, great, now we have Black Hawks flying around. That's part of it. But it is also a mind shift to be able to say that a border goes both ways. It's a little bit like having a fence with a neighbor. You care about one side for sure and what goes on, but you're also going to be a good neighbor. You're going to care about both sides of what goes on. And I'm not distracted by the conversation around tariffs. It's easily to, and it's easily to be pouty, but I'm not. Because I think back to like an evening that I had last night. So the Vancouver police, kind enough to be able to tour me through the city, in particular the downtown east side. So I think of myself as, pretty current. Peter will remind me, Kevin, it wasn't just 5 years ago that you were patrolling Burnaby and coming down to the downtown east side. It was almost 30 years ago when it was heroin that we were dealing with. But it is incredibly, incredibly tragic. And a microcosm, colleagues, because it is again an expression of where we find ourselves in 2025, despite an incredible amount of resources being deployed, but clearly ineffectively. And I was really struck by the compassion and dedication to the community demonstrated by those by the police officers I met, as well as those involved in needle exchange and others in the public health sector that I met last night. And I know it's a bit of a, I don't want to be that guy that spends a couple hours and now knows all the issues. You all know it far better than me, but it was quite stark and quite profound. So as part of the border plan, some other things around pulling the tools and having the tools, listing 7 criminal organizations as terrorist entities. I never thought I'd see that in Canada. So there's another tool, Section 83 of the Criminal Code starts to become alive and well. Health Canada with new detection laboratory capacity, which is incredibly important to be able to know, to be able to track and trace what's going on at least a timely manner as possibly you can. The Canadian Security Establishment, you know them as CSE, our SIGINT organization, is now sharing intelligence with law enforcement with respect to criminal organizations, which is quite new. And then the Integrated Money Laundering Intelligence or Information Partnership with big banks that I participate in, which again is very important to focus in on the money laundering elements. But new legislation alone will not achieve the necessary deterrence and that active, resourced, and aggressive forfeiture can have. So it is important, and that intentionality that's really really key. There's been an incredible amount of law enforcement activities carried out with respect to synthetic opioids in this country. Hundreds of arrests, kilograms have been seized, millions in cash taken, cars, etc. Even as recently as last week, and the results matter, and of course they matter, but we're not done. We need to double down, colleagues, because the narconomics of the situation is such that you can take down labs, but the cost of production are so low, the ease of production are so low, no longer do you need to deal with poppy farmers or coca farmers. You are able to actually just use the chemicals and be able to produce and reproduce the labs incredibly quickly. So that's what really ends up being really key in terms of the core message ultimately, is that everybody in this room, whether you're a regulator, prosecutor, policy expert, investigator, you really are essential to the national strategy. You understand the financial mechanics, you know how to trace shell companies, exploit cross-border data, challenge beneficial ownership, and go after the assets that fund the misery. It's a whole of society challenge. That means access to FinTrack and CRA records, reforms to the Bank Act, coordinated litigation strategies across province, and the continued leadership of provinces and people like you, the province of BC, whose work is now shaping Canada's approach to the FATF evaluation later on this year. So look, let me just conclude by saying that every dollar we seize is one that won't be used to fuel more death. Every asset we freeze weakens the grip of organized crime. Every UWO filed tells the public, your neighbor and mine, that your government is fighting back, not just with words, but with actions and results. And again, I don't want to be a bad host, but I don't want Canada to be the place where anybody feels comfortable where they can ply a trade that causes death and despair and can profit by it. So my ask of you, my call to action for all of you, is to think about the work that you do in that context. Lean in, step up, and don't let up. Don't be the person that has 50 reasons why not. Find the one reason why you can. In addition to the changes in law and public resource investments, I think we also need to ask ourselves, have we got that operational mindset in any of our organization? Have we got it in terms of the culture? Are we there? Are we there to help? Or are we being a hindrance to achieving these goals? The way we do things around here, as you know, That culture will eat any strategy for breakfast. Is our collective risk of failure, what's our risk tolerance for failure? And what are those criteria? Are we satisfied with failure once in a while to be able to push the envelope? We'll do so. It's not just about enforcement, as I say, and frankly, it's about the economic, the fabric of this country and our national security, and it's about saving lives. So I think we have the tools. If you need more tools, you ask me. I will do all I can to get you the tools you need. You have, and we have, collectively the mandate, and we should be incentivized and incited to act. So please do. Thank you very much.
That was Canada's fentanyl czar, Kevin Brosseau, at the Vancouver Anti-Corruption Institute's 2025 conference on asset forfeiture. Ellen Mullen is the former chief of staff to Daryl Plakas, the speaker of the British Columbia legislature from 2017 to 2020. Ellen has been a guest on several previous editions of the podcast, but this time on a somber topic, the aftermath of the June 14th assassination of Melissa Hortman, the former speaker of the Minnesota state legislature. Ellen traveled to legislatures on both sides of the U.S.-Canada border for his 2020 report to the Legislative Assembly Management Committee in Victoria about improving security and cutting waste. His tour took him to the Minnesota capital in St. Paul, where he met with Melissa Hortman. Here is my interview with Ellen Mullen. Ellen, walk back to the time that you were in St. Paul. You went to the Minnesota legislature and met then Speaker Melissa Hortman.
So I was there, Bob, as you just mentioned, doing a fact-finding investigation, if you will, just learning about how other jurisdictions do security, both at their legislature, but also for elected officials and representatives. Melissa Hortman had just been elected the previous January. I met with her in the summer of 2019 to sort of sit and discuss from sort of her view and her office's view on security of the legislature. It was a wonderful meeting. It lasted about 40 minutes, which is longer than you would usually meet with a speaker or a minister or elected official. She was very gracious with her time. She was a very forward-thinking Democrat. And interestingly enough, she had a lot of views on security and safety of the legislature, of elected officials and you know, sort of public servants. She was known and is known for her views on, you know, sort of police reform. She sort of brought bills forward for limiting neck restraints and chokeholds, et cetera, on behalf of police. So she had a real keen sense when it came to safety and security. So it was definitely an honor to sort of meet with her and speak with her and sort of devastating news to hear of the assassination of her and her husband.
CSIS, the Canadian Security Intelligence Service, in its 2024 report just released in June, it warns of ideologically and politically motivated violent extremism coming from the far left and the far right, as well as people who are connected to foreign causes. It is on the radar for our authorities here. Do you think that our authorities here, though, are taking it as seriously enough as they should?
I mean, definitely the discussion is taking place. I think, you know, fortunately, we do have a Minister of Public Safety and Solicitor General who's a former police officer, former inspector, and that's Gary Begg. And I've had personal discussions with Minister Begg regarding safety and security of elected officials, and he couldn't agree more. Agreeing, though, and getting stuff done are two different things. He's made a commitment to refocus some efforts and some resources to the safety and security of elected officials, but also of representatives. And by that, I mean, you know, folks like the lieutenant governor. Her honor is the representative of the king, obviously. And, you know, so then you not only have the extremists that say, well, it's an elected official or a representative that I'm targeting, but I'm going to target, you know, folks that have representation to other countries as well. So, you know, when you see the premier having a security detail, my question is always, you know, there's certain incidents and functions that these folks attend, not all, but that they do require that extra safety and security. And I think we need to place a larger focus on that, you know, both municipally, provincially, and federally, because it's only a matter of time, in my view, as you said, with these sort of extremists on the left, extremists on the right, we're seeing it all over the world where threats are made and, you know, these folks are in positions of public trust, and we need to protect them. And we need to, in this day and age, we've seen what happened on June 14th with the former Speaker Hortman. Something's going to happen here. We need to get serious about it, have the discussions, but then take those discussions and actually put them into action.
What does it do to democracy? And does it keep people on the sidelines, people that might be good people who are great leaders, ethical leaders who want to get into the public realm, who might look at this and say, no, not for me. I don't want to risk this. Don't want to risk the safety of myself or my family or friends. So does that have a chilling effect on our democracy, especially when we really should be expressing that our politicians should only fear one thing? They should fear the pencil, the paper, and the ballot box. That's what they should be living in fear of every day. They shouldn't be living in fear of anything else.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And I do think it has a negative effect and a negative impact on you know, sort of the people wanting to run for office or wanting to be, you know, represent their community or their ideas. You know, it wouldn't much matter to me what your political views are, what your thoughts are, you know, what side of the aisle you sit on. Every member that is elected or is a representative in one way or another has the basic right to personal safety. And we as a society expect those leaders and those representatives to do their job. And if they are constantly fearful, or they're even fearful of going to a public event, then that seriously restricts their ability to do the job that they've been elected or tasked to, you know, to do. It is the responsibility of our current administrations and our current representatives to put things in place to make sure that anybody, you know, in a democratic society can run for office or can take on, you know, these representative posts without fear of, you know, retribution, without fear of attack or even threats. That's not okay in any civil society, and it's happening more and more and more where these folks are getting threatened or assaulted or abused, or worse in the case of Speaker Hortman's case. So we need to get serious about it. We need to put these checks and balances in place, because otherwise we are going to see a decline in, you know, the really talented folks that want to step up and serve. They'll say, not for me. I'm not putting myself or my family at risk. And that's not okay, Bob.
When Darrell Plekis was Speaker and you were his Chief of Staff in the early days of uncovering the scandal that was involving the clerk and the Sergeant at Arms and other matters that were going behind the scenes, both of you were fearing for your safety.
Absolutely. Speaker Plekis and I both together and separately received numerous threats. Obviously lots of abuse, which is sort of well documented in the media, various people in the community not liking what we were doing or not understanding what we were doing, you know, threatening to burn us or spit on us in the street, but also, excuse me, worse, threatening, you know, serious bodily harm or death. That's not okay. You know, we're talking about trying to do the right thing and, you know, having a view of protecting the public purse. And it's okay to disagree. That's what makes democracy great, is having those discussions and having disagreements and having debate. But what's not okay is to threaten anybody, especially these folks who are trying to do the right thing. And I experienced it firsthand. My family did, as well as Speaker Plekis and his family. And it does not feel good. And it doesn't much matter, you know, how strong of a person you are. That weighs on you, and it does. It made me, and I know for Speaker Plekis as well, it made us question, well, are we doing the right thing here then? Not necessarily for the public, the taxpayer. Are we doing the right thing for us and our family? Because at the end of the day, nothing is more important to any of us than family. And it gets scary. So something's got to change here. And I mean, that we're talking about 2018, 2019, and this stuff is still happening. We got to do better, Bob.
So thanks again for being on the Breaker.News to talk about this, and look forward to the next time.
Thanks for having me, Bob. Always great to be with you.
That was Alan Mullen, the former Chief of Staff to Darrell Plekis, who was the Speaker of British Columbia's legislature from 2017 to 2020.
news podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim.
In FocusTaiwan.tw, Taiwan expects higher than usual rice exports to Japan in 2025. Taiwan could export up to 12,000 metric tons of rice to Japan this year, Agriculture Minister Chen Junji told the Taipei International Food Show. Taiwan typically exports about 3,500 metric tons of rice to Japan annually, but that figure has already reached 8,700 metric tons this year, an increase likely driven by a rice shortage in Japan. In ABC News Australia, endurance athlete Phil Gore sets backyard ultra world record at Dead Cow Gully, running almost 800 kilometers in 5 days. Gore covered 6.7 kilometers every hour after he started running on Saturday morning. His 119 loops broke the previous world record held by Belgian Lucas Rubel by 3 loops. Billed as a race with no finish line, the backyard ultra format has no predefined length of time. And in Kyoto news, world's first triple amputee sailor across Pacific arrives in Japan. A British Army veteran who lost both legs and his left hand in Afghanistan made history. He sailed solo across the Pacific. Craig Wood, 34, departed Mexico in March, and he sailed around 13,000 kilometers on a 12.5-meter custom-built aluminum catamaran for 90 days before arriving in Hiroshima port. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In Willamette Week, Portland woman sues man who smeared dog poop in her hair. Emma Gilliland is seeking $245,000 in civil damages from Leon Plumakers, who also faces criminal charges of harassment and criminal mischief in Multnomah County Circuit Court. Gilliland sued Plumakers on June 10th, accusing him of overreacting when her dog, Penny, pooped on a parking strip during a May 9th walk. In Crosscut, Washington says Trump's Hanford cleanup budget falls $1.5 billion short. On the heels of federal layoffs, legislators and environmental watchdogs are concerned about the nuclear site meeting its legal obligations. Washington Department of Ecology estimated that $3.79 billion would have been necessary in fiscal 2024 to meet Hanford's legal cleanup schedule and standards. The feds budgeted $3.07 billion this year. Hanford's legal target calls for glassifying all wastes by 2052. And check out thebreaker.news and bobmackin.substack.com for the stories behind these headlines. NDP eager to spend millions more to subsidize FIFA, but not on a girl with a rare disease. And Elections BC admits error in Surrey-Guildford, where the EBNDP scored its majority. Read the stories behind the headlines. Go to thebreaker.news and bobmackin.substack.com. That's Cascadia Calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
It don't matter what color you are, cause love will conquer hate, so you won't stand alone, you won't stand alone.
The Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to Canadians, all 41 million of you. Here's to the 158th birthday of the Dominion on Canada Day. And you can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo bar? Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. That is the sound of Gramophonic from Washington, D.C. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of June 29th, 2025. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 29th of June in 1922, France granted Canada 1 square kilometer at Vimy Ridge, free and for all time? 3,600 Canadians died in 1917 at the World War I battleground. Now you know. Send me your feedback, send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. And introducing bobmackin.substack.com. Visit me there too. Sign up for the free email newsletter and get updates to your inbox, or follow The Breaker News for news as it happens on X, formerly Twitter. And you can support The Breaker for as little as $7 a month. For more information, go to bobmackin.substack.com. Until next week.